The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, the pitch gets a bit sticky and the umpire might call a foul. Dave builds the chain and looks for the weak link. Roger makes music out of instruments. Jennifer wins in a competitive world, more fraud, spies, and lies, and a whole lot more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
So, Dean, tell me about, you know, yourself and your company. What do you do? What's the name of the company?
Sure. So my name is Dean Funsell, and the company's name is National Adhesive. We've been around in the U.S. for about 4.5 years. I'm originally from Southern Africa, and we sell to the consumer market through big box retailers like Home Depot, Lowe's.
Okay. What do you sell?
I sell glue, corks, sealants, and tapes.
Oh, there you go. Adhesives.
Adhesives.
Thus the name National Adhesive. Good choice. but it's actually International Adhesive, right?
This is true. Yeah, our sister company started in South Africa probably about 27 years ago.
So we could tell by your accent that you weren't from the coast of California, but South Africa, that's different, right? We get a lot of people from, you know, Japan, but you're like way over on the other side of the world. So what is it, a 12-hour time zone?
It's actually only 6 hours and on daylight saving 7 hours. So it just depends on time of the year.
So your company has been going on for a long time, and you sell now. One of the things I was most impressed with was some of the brands that you now apparently own or sell. Because, you know, you tell us some of the brands.
Well, we got three of our own brands that we own directly. One's called Glue Angel. Another one's Thick, which is a construction side of things. And then we got Ish, which is a word from Southern Africa of amazement. And it's our price point brand. And then we've got a licensing agreement with DuPont for the Great Stuff brand. So the Great Stuff foam sealant has been around in the U.S. for about 45 years.
Yeah. So Great Stuff, you know, my father-in-law taught me about Great Stuff. You know, you go to the hardware store, and I'm not going to name the hardware stores around here. They're mostly national chains, but we don't want to give them the free advertising. If you want to advertise, send us cash. We'll be happy to name your We go to the store, and you say, oh, what are you looking for? Great Stuff. And you know, the people in hardware, they know, oh, yeah, I know Great Stuff. That's Great Stuff. It does the job, right?
So exactly.
You know, what a fantastic name for a product. So this was a DuPont product originally. And so how did you end up being the wholesalers or what is licensing?
Well, So DuPont is still selling the foam sealant that we traditionally know, but we've licensed the brand to expand the range. So we're now doing corks and sealants, adhesives. And tapes, all under the same brand. So we work closely with DuPont. So we're responsible totally from start to finish for the new products.
So they're all called Great Stuff, but they're just different Great Stuff.
Correct. So now you've got Great Stuff corks and sealants. You've got Great Stuff adhesives. You've got Great Stuff tapes. So, you know, they expand in the repertoire.
Well, that's Great Stuff. So now tell me about do you manufacture this stuff or DuPont makes it all?
So DuPont doesn't make anything. We literally only license the brand.
Wait a minute. That's in your space. So you're not saying DuPont doesn't make anything at all, do they?
Oh, no, they make a lot, but none of the products that we're selling.
All right, so do you actually make the stuff?
No, so we utilize third parties around the world. So we bring in products in with exclusive agreements for, because we work on the formulation with these manufacturers, and we've got 7 different countries that we work in. So we own the formulations, they manufacture the products for us, and we just manage the whole process.
All right, so they make it and ship it, they drop ship it to your customers, you set up the big supply chain and demand chain, right?
So they manufacture in bulk. So we'll bring in containers at a time, we bring it into the US, we then warehouse it, redistribute it, whether it's major retailers we send bulk to, or it's drop shipping we do as well. So we fully, from manufacture, We take over after that part.
Do you do packaging or you just...
We design the packaging. We utilize somebody else to do the packaging for us, but we're responsible for the design, look, feel, marketing, sales, distribution, all of it.
So how big exactly is this?
How big is it now or how big will it be? That's the question.
Well, let's talk. You've been doing it for, you know, almost 30 years. So how big was it? How did you get from there to here? And how big is it now? And then how soon is it getting to where?
Sure. So let me put in perspective. The Southern African company is selling into 18 different countries. We started only selling products here in the US at the end of last year. And by the end of next year, we will be more than double the size of the South African operation. And obviously expanding rapidly, excuse the pun.
Numbers. Give me numbers, right?
Yeah. 20 million in the South African company at the moment.
$20 million of annual sales?
Correct.
All right. Now, people will want to know what your margin is, and they'll probably resent you after you tell me. But what is your margin?
Not as high as the retailers, so that much I can tell you. Our average margin is about 45 to 50%.
Oh, that's not bad at all. That's awful good.
You know, it could be worse.
Yeah, it couldn't be much better. You know, so the retailers take more than that. So when we pay a dollar to the retailer, they give you 50 cents. No, they give you 30 cents and you keep 15 of it, right?
It's even worse than that. But yeah, pretty much.
Oh, no. That's horrible.
Don't want to give too many secrets away, but yes.
So have you thought about doing direct sales like over the internet?
So we have started. We actually launched some of our first our own brands. And now this actually next week, we're launching some of the Great Stuff brands. So, you know, Amazon, you'll start seeing our products on there, and that's direct to consumer. So we're doing a mix of everything, you know, either through the retailers, through their e-commerce sites or direct. It's going to be a mix. And yes, the margins are much healthier when we do it ourselves.
Well, Amazon takes their fair share too, right?
It's still not as bad.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely. And you don't have the same, you know, it's different shipping and packaging and all that. The other side is, though, that the big, you know, chains, you know, they do a lot of business, right? So it's...
It's volume. It's all volume driven.
Yeah, sure. Whereas if you're sending one at a time and putting a postage stamp on it, you know, you can't sell a billion. All right. So today in the U.S., you're selling how many?
In terms of units, we're selling a few million units at a time at the moment.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, a few million at a time, and you must get a dollar each, or is it even less than that?
It's less, unfortunately, I'd like to say. Okay. It depends on the product. You know, some products more. Yeah, it's, you know, we got one or two products we'd like to sell more. We got really good margins. And then you've obviously got those horrible loss leaders, which tend to make up the bulk of your volume.
Right. You know, that's the old story, right? Well, you know, at volume 1,000, I'm losing a dollar each. But at volume 10 million, I'm only losing 50 cents. Don't scale that way. Thank you. All right.
Yeah.
So, but you are, you're successfully losing money today, right?
Correct. We are very successfully losing money today. But tomorrow, a different story.
So, but as you scale, you know, when looking at your numbers, and by the way, you know, the people on the show, if they're accredited investors, they can go to thecybershow.co and click on National Adhesive Incorporated, or click on your GWiz, and they'll be able to drill down into details. Again, accredited investors only, and find out all about it. And we'll also, if you have a website working at that point, we'll put up your URL for your website so they can click through and buy directly. Do they get a discount, and do I get a cut?
We can talk after the show.
Yeah. Well, at least you're nice about it. Most people say, no, you don't get any, but they'll get a discount. No problem. It's fine. You know,
we are very, very price point competitive. Let's put it that way.
Oh, well, that's fantastic, which means that you're not making enough money. All right. So, and you can't tell us about your, you know, investment or anything on the air because there are restrictions on that. But so how big, what do you think in 5 years from now, how many billions of dollars would you sell in the U.S.?
Well, you know, I look at it in two different ways. You know, I look at it the realistic worst case scenario and, you know, the optimistically target. You know, worst case, we want to be doing 250 million. Best case, we want to be doing 500 million.
Well, that's not a very big range, 250 or 500 million. So at 250 million units of dollars, $250 million of sales, you're probably only losing 15 or 20 million, right?
No, at that stage, we better be making money. Otherwise, okay. I'm doing something horribly wrong.
Excellent. All right. Now, this is the cyber show. So you got to tell us, there's got to be gobs of cyber involved in making this stuff, shipping it, packaging it, everything else. This is stuff, you know, you can't sniff this or else, you know, you'll get well, first you'll get high and then you'll die, right?
Something like that. We are working on some really amazing greener, let's call them greener products. So that's exciting. But yeah, on the cyber side, I mean, it's one of those things. We spent a lot of time initially setting up the infrastructure first. And, you know, everything's connected through a strong ERP system. You know, all of our connections between our retailers are EDI connected. So there's a lot of back end work.
You're going into initials, and not only do the people on the air not know them all, I'm not sure, but ERP and EDI, I think EDI is electronic data interchange.
Correct.
And ERP is enterprise resource planning or something?
Yeah, so NetSuite, Oracle NetSuite, you know, so it's basically, it's the backbone.
All right, please don't advertise for those big companies here. Just tell us.
Apologies.
Yeah, well, unless you can hook us up. Yeah, I mean, if they want to buy some advertising, we're happy to talk all about them all day. All right, so do you have your own plants? You outsource all the manufacturing, right?
So we outsource all the, you know, we let the specialists do what they're good at, and we focus on what we're good at, which is basically capturing the market, bringing it all together into a working scenario, and make sure that it runs smoothly with as little hands-on as possible.
There you go. Okay, so they can go to the cybershow.co and look up your company, and it looks like a great opportunity to invest, but I haven't done due diligence on it or anything yet, so we'll be talking about that later. In any case, Dean, it's great to have you on the show. I just want to say your interview, this has been great stuff.
Thanks, Brett. I appreciate that.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full of double. Papers flying. Everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. A brilliant defensive cybersecurity tactic in the last week reduced break-ins to electronic hotel room locks by cyber thieves to near zero on the Vegas Strip. Asked about the origin of this stunning defensive victory, MGM Hotels replied with a no comment. In an apparently unrelated story, patrons at some hotels were unable to get into their rooms because of a computer glitch. And that's breaking news on the Cyber Show.
David Zendizian has spent a career in the high-volume, large, heavy part of the world involved in transportation, and more specifically, shipping and logistics. This is at the heart of everything we get in the world that isn't grown in our own backyard.
On that, you know, so before we started recording, we're talking S-bomb, the supply chain, you know, where I'm spending a lot of my time right now. A lot of us and our peers are spending a lot of time on it. And what gets interesting to me, I think, is the interest, you know, see if we can put together an intersection of your career and your path, right? You know, there's that logistics from, you know, your very first computer job. You know, how do you put all these things together in the days when there's 18 computer technology, not computer security, computer technology majors in a significant university, to, you know, if Silicon Valley and those first jobs to where you are right now, and the policy, you know, stuff we were talking about in the last segment. Let me see if I can put this in the form of a question. You know, how do you see that part, you know, that shipping and logistics and policy playing into your sort of daily, weekly world now, as opposed to other people who may not have followed that path?
But one thing that helps me on, you know, thinking of logistics and shipping is very few people understand what it takes to get their device to them. You know, it's one thing to talk about a D-bomb or an S-bomb or whatever, you know, what makes the material, how do you put it together, but how do you get it? You know, I love my truck. It's out front. I'm a huge Ford fanatic. Let's not even go down that path to some people. But But think about building of a truck. You know, there might be a piece in the truck that has a chip made in Singapore that's sent to Vietnam to be put onto a board that is sent to Korea. You know, so it's like the steps of actually making these parts come together, and then the logistics of combining, you know, 6,000 parts. And the timing of making those go together is something that most people just have no idea what that takes to come together. And that's the basis of where I started my life is, you know, most of the shipping and stuff I dealt with in the Southeast was around paper mills and shipping of large bulk paper from the paper mill to the ports to the world. Like, you're building stuff with paper. It may have come, well, you're in Canada. Canada has its own paper mills. You probably got it from up there. But, you know, Georgia Pacific and all the other stuff around the Southeast, which you're in Florida now, you've probably worked in and around the stuff that I dealt with. Now, it doesn't mean that it's a huge difference to go at the logistics of shipping a cell phone. You know, it's the same basic concepts. One of my oldest friends, he just died recently. I miss him. He actually ended up moving to New Orleans, was a commodities broker. You know, the idea of somebody who leases an entire ship just so he can go to like different ports and fill it up with grain or different things. And then, you know, he's making a bet that he's going to actually be able to make money on an entire ship or fleet of ships being leased and moving around. And you tie those stories together into, what does it take to make a business work? You know, then you start talking about the policies. Yeah, policies give you a structure of risk. You know, how do you approach doing business with the risks of the world around it? And those risks have changed. You know, the basic concepts of risks haven't changed, but the avenues we are open to attack are, you know, everyone does business on their cell phone now. 10 years ago, that didn't happen. You know, so now we have a work profile. You know, your phones didn't have work profiles before. Now we might have two different phones for your work. So the world has expanded. But if you understand the logistics of how we communicate, and then how do we build the structure of risk mitigation through policies, everything else is common amongst any other industry. So you go to any industry, you go to, you know, any retail, so PCI, and based on the structure of actually getting assets and selling in retail stores and actually minimizing your risk. And you have the worry now of people going to the store and actually stealing your products. That's a huge problem these days. You go into almost any market, you know, you have fraud, you have insider threats, you have, you know, all these things to worry about. I personally like to stay with the software side. While I enjoy the idea of being a CISO for a company again, I know myself that if I go beyond my current role, I will probably be, you know, VP of application architecture. Something that deals with the application and data, because people are hard. They do some crazy, stupid stuff, and either intentionally or not. And it's hard to protect
them. Bless their hearts.
Yeah. And there are people who love to protect that. There are people who love to do penetration testing on people and do social engineering and trying to find ways of securing people. But honestly, more power to them. I'll stick with the data and the applications, because that's what runs the world.
Very well said.
Boy, you know, policy structures risks.
Right.
Well, it's a fascinating phrase.
Right.
You know, it's one of those things that I have to think about. It's not obvious why it is that policy structures risk, right? So when you talk about risk, risk is the uncertainty about the future. And policy is generally designed to try and constrain the future, if that makes sense.
Right.
So the uncertainties about the future are being constrained by your proclamation of what you're going to do and not do. But the reality of what you do is what causes all of those risks that we call, what's the right word? Unanticipated, right? Unanticipated consequences.
Yep.
So I think to that extent, policy does the opposite. Policy blinds you to risks because policy is not perfectly implemented. And so executives in particular, in most entities, create policy, create legal documents and so forth. They create all these structures to try to manage risks, that is, manage the future outcomes, but they tend to fail to recognize what's going on at those lower levels. And you talk about this as the way people came up from one place to another in the world. You know, so I started here and I worked my way through that and so forth. And in some sense, I may have just been brought up or you know, somehow by luck ended up being brought up in a manner that makes me extremely aware of the realities and the differences between those policies and the realities and the need for redundancy in the implementation and so forth. So it's sort of fascinating to me to listen to this conception of it. And there's a little bit of a disconnect between that conception and the reality. No, not a little bit. Let's say a vast. And so I think people misinterpret, especially rules, especially, I'll call it logical thinkers, but that's not the right word, us engineering types and mathematicians and so forth, that believe that the rules define the nature of what's going on. And they try to follow those rules in a very precise sort of manner. And they don't recognize that the lines are not just very thin, but they're very dim. they may not exactly exist.
Well, you know, there's too much reliance on anything. You know, I'm thinking about what I call a TAM, right? You know, the TAM, the 360 avoidance maneuver, right? This is a policy I have when I'm sailing these boats. And if you're out there, you know, we talk about these, you know, silly boats I'm sailing. Imagine two boats that are 24 feet long and 10 feet wide, wrapped up next to each other, basically a 24-foot cube, and you're sailing along at low speeds in weird conditions. So the TAM is a policy that I can trigger at any one point. Policies, as I'm thinking about this right now, policy for me is kind of like a little hack. It's a little gadget, right? You know, in case of fire, press that button. Now, does it put the fire out? Ah, maybe, right? But it does a known thing as a policy, right? And a 360 avoidance maneuver I've used over and over and over again. But, you know, if I catch a corner of the boat on something, I just throw the steering motor over to 90 degrees, put the boats into a spin. You know, by the time you're pointing straight again, things have changed. You know, that just it just reliably works. So if you rely on policies to give you, you know, expected processes to behave in situations, then they can be useful. And you know, and turning this, you know, to the cyber side of things, I think AI, you know, these, you know, ChatGPT or whatever everybody's, you know, talking about right now, and our fear, uncertainty, and doubt about all that stuff, is just a policy thing. And when I read, you know, I have yet to really use these tools, but you know, if I write a press release, I would really like to have it, you know, have a large language model write me the draft. That doesn't mean that it wrote the press release. It means that I didn't do a TAM. I didn't have to actually flip the tiller over and spin the boat 360 because, you know, that's not the point. The point is when I'm running that policy, it gives me enough time as the human operator to figure things out. So policies and tools and technology are really just ways to, you know, get an expected result and sometimes buy yourself some time.
So they talk about this a lot. It's called a playbook. So when you talk about, you know, response methodologies, and I don't know what they call it these days, it's DevOps or SecOps or OpsOps. They have their playbooks, right? They say this is related to, so in the nuclear world, there's what's called indications and warnings. And that applies to the military more broadly and in general. And the idea is that you have these indicators, and when enough of the indicators in the right configuration show up in the right sequence, then you deliver a warning. And the warning says, you can reasonably expect in the next so much time, this bad thing is going to happen, right? And depending on the how much time and how bad the thing is, for the nuclear war world, the playbooks are done. I mean, you know, there's no deviation from the playbook. You have not enough time to do anything else. So when the playbooks are, you know, when the decision-making is programmed decisions, the playbooks are almost completely automated, maybe with the decision-maker in the loop somewhere. As time frames go up and the decisions become more complex and different in nature, the playbooks become more complex. And then there are things we just don't have playbooks for because, you know, they don't happen that often. So I think that's one of the things about learning from experience, right? People learn from experience. They build their own playbook in their head, and the ability to write it down and communicate it and get it to where it's built in is sort of the next step in the maturation of an entity or a person or whatever else, right? So I think it's sort of interesting that you talk about using a large language model or some such thing, that the learning capability of learning situations and playbooks, you know, that's part of that human learning capability that allows us to generalize. And AI is not good at generalization. Lots of people have done research on it, but you know, they're not that good at generalization. People are very good at generalization. And so just a comment, I still end up writing it down and then programming it to do it instead of letting the AI try and figure it out, because it doesn't. But those playbooks seem to me like that's what we're going after.
Right. You know, I think about, of course, AI captains and boats all the time. You know, all the sailing that I do, how do I train an AI to do that? You know, and the answer is, how would I train another person to do that? Right. And I
had but that's not how you train AI to do it. When you say AI, again, that term is problematic. Automation, right?
Automation.
What you do is you create the playbooks, you identify the indicators and the warnings. The indications happen. The automation says, aha, we are in this mode that requires a book response. And we execute the book and you program the book. Don't say, oh, go learn the book. You program it. And you know that it's not going to work all the time. And it doesn't matter. It's better than the alternative, which is to say it gives you time to figure it out. And if you're sitting on the boat and it starts to do the TAM, the 360 turn, You're sitting on the boat and you've got recognition built into your brain that says, whoa, hey, the boat's doing one of these things. Okay, I better look, right?
Right.
And when you have remote piloting operating, then the TAM maneuver says, oh, it's time for a delay. And the operator calls up and says, okay, remote pilot, help. And the right. remote pilot has enough time, if you do it right, to see the circumstance and say, okay, this is not, you know, either pre-programmed number 7. It's one of those I've seen before. Or, oh, my God, I haven't seen this one before. So,
yes.
So I'll do that manually for a while, and then we'll take note of that. And if it happens again, we're going to put it in the book.
Right.
And I think, yeah, when you say learn, I think that's how you're ultimately going to develop the systems. And you're never going to run out of all the possibilities, but you're going to sure make it rare.
Right. And I think the same applies to policy writ large. I mean, you know, the largest picture.
This isn't policy. This is procedure.
Yeah, policy, procedure, enforcement, visibility, transparency, right? You know, like your example of, you know, swarm, you know, planning and swarming and robbing a store. Right. You know, that works because though it may be illegal and so forth, enforcement, you know, is basically impossible. So it works for now. Right. You know, but I think more about cynicism. Right. You know, easier to believe that I, you know, either can get away with something because everybody else does, or I can't, even though everybody else does. And I think that's an unstable condition. Right. And I think we can get transparency that allows us to mitigate a lot of this stuff. Right. And the analogy with the boats is very similar, right? Where, you know, it's not that we make anything perfect. These are human systems. But, you know, we have such opacity today into, you know, what policies and what enforcement, what governance and what enforcement actually is, that anybody can assume anything and support it.
So this goes back to, I think, the inappropriate misunderstanding of privacy as a priority. And it has to do with sort of the fundamental. Long ago, you would hear about security incidents. You know, oh, somebody broke into the computer at the Pentagon and whatever the description was, followed by, but no classified information was leaked. Okay, they didn't mention that 473 people just got killed. There was an explosion and fire, and we disabled the entire military for 6 months, but no classified information was leaked. Okay, so I think that, by the way, never, as far as I'm aware, happened, but they wouldn't tell me if it was classified anyway. But I think the point here is that it's an emphasis on the wrong thing. I think surveillance is a good thing and in a lot of ways. And so I understand the desire for privacy, and I don't have surveillance, you know, inside my house, at least not much of it that I, you know, can't turn off as far as I'm aware, because guess what? My wife has a phone and she carries it everywhere. I have a phone and I carry it. But my point being that if I don't want somebody to see how I choose to behave, you know, with my wife in a private setting, I can make it so there's not substantial or real surveillance there. Obviously, if somebody wants to, you know, if the CIA wants to know or the NSA wants to know, they will put side-looking radar and micro cameras and all sorts of stuff, as we've discussed before. But for the most part, privacy I can get when and if I want it, but I should not expect it everywhere all the time. And in particular,
right, when walking down the street. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you're not private when you're walking down the street. Other people can see you. When right. you're robbing a store, I think you certainly don't have the right to privacy. And I think that being able to track the people that robbed the store, where they came from, where they went to, oh, okay, so you blotted out your license plate, but it was this kind of car, it was in this location. We keep watching, and eventually we're going to get an identification of you and then take you away. And I was talking about this in an online discussion earlier today, which is one of the reasons it comes to mind. And people are saying, oh, loss of this, loss of that. Yeah, baloney. How about loss of civil society? And their complaint is that civil society is going away. And it's not that civil society is going away because this can happen. Civil society is going away because of the combination, in my view, of the motivation of people to do it and the lack of the willingness to enforce. It's not the ability, it's the willingness.
Well, and again, that's possible because there's no transparency into, like, we, you know, it's this old, you know, the old joke is like four people write a letter to because they don't like a TV show, but the TV station has an algorithm they use for every letter. They assume that there's 10,000 people who didn't write letters. That means 40,000 people wrote letters. Like, but in fact, we're four, right?
Of course, the counter to that policy is that you and I know that we're going to write 27 letters to each congressman under different names. from different parts of their district, and that that will cause them to change their mind. And then, of course, the people that want to counter that know the same thing. So it comes into this escalation process where all of the system is corrupted because they don't know what's going on. It's just a matter of people exploiting the cognitive mechanisms of the system.
Well, but this loss of civil society, I think we have as Americans, you know, in Canadians and, you know, a lot of the world I can think of, we have this belief that the civil society has been lost because we hear people saying it a lot. But in reality, you know, our daily lives, we don't interact with that many people and we may not see incivility. But again, I can tell you, because I do interact with a lot of people of all types all the time, and civil society is not lost. You know, almost everybody is actually very civil almost all the time.
Yeah, right? unless you trigger the things that cause them to be uncivil.
Right, right. And those can be right or wrong, but they're usually fairly obvious, right? And it's like, you know.
Well, they may be obvious to you because you're an intelligent, thoughtful person who thinks through and understands these issues.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions.
Well, good point. I mean, it depends how much you believe in a startup, I guess. For example, you wouldn't get pro rata rights, right, unless you knew to ask for them.
All right, so explain to everybody what pro rata rates are, right? So,
well, think of this. Suppose I'm an investor and I invest in a company and I put my $5,000 or $10,000 in and a company takes off. It's going to be a home run. It's doing really well. And now it's attracted a big name venture capitalist who's going to put money in. And, you know, they're pretty serious and they're going to provide runway for this company. Well, God, I'd like to participate in that. I'd like to be able to maintain my percentage interest in the company. Well, unless I've got that right, you know, unless I've negotiated that right, that pro rata right or right to maintain, I don't have it, right? So when you think
that's one path to it. But part of the problem is, you know, when it gets up to that level, you may want to invest that, but you don't necessarily have that much money, right? When they're bringing in $50 million, unless you have another $5 million to put in, you can't keep up.
I might want to, you know, I mean, a lot of times people will make these early stage investments. So they'll shotgun it. Like you said, they'll have 30 of them just for the opportunity to see who's going to win and then to double down on the winners.
Yeah, we have a strategy in this regard as well. And again, you've seen our contracts that allow us to do that. But what do you think of non-dilutive funding? We've had this discussion before.
Well, when you say non-dilutive funding, that can mean a lot of different things. Do you mean like government grants? Do you mean revenues?
Sorry. We love non-dilutive funding in that sense. I'm talking about investors that invest and get a non-diluting right. That is, when they buy their 10% of the company today, it's guaranteed to continue to be worth 10% throughout the lifetime of the company.
Yeah, I never do that. I do see something like that. It's called the post-money safe, which guarantees that when a safe converts into equity, it's going to get a certain percentage of the company. Roughly stated, that's, you know, it's not 100% accurate, but that's the general idea. And sometimes I see investors take warrants to maintain a certain percentage. But what you're describing, I've only seen that a few times in my career, and I don't like it. I think it's because that non-dilutive portion has to come out of somebody's high, and I typically represent the company. That means the founder is going to pick that up, because the next investor that comes around, you know, they know what percent of the company they want for their money, right? So and normally that means everybody dilutes. And if somebody's not going to, that means someone else has to dilute more, right?
So let's talk a little bit about that, because I think that this is how founders get, I think I'm allowed to say it on the air. I think all founders should have a small percentage of the company that's not dilutive, that there should be 5-10%, something like that, of the company equity that is non-dilutive, that's owned by the founders and the very early investors. And everybody else can be in that 90%. But that small 5-10% should be something that's permanent for the people that put in the time and effort up front, that made the big bet, that got this thing launched. Because when you look at it, the people coming in later, you know, they're not making anywhere near as big a risk, as big a bet. So why should they be favored just because they have money? And of course, the answer is because they have the money. But
well, a couple of things. You know, you can try all you want to hardwire your company, but the guys with the money are gonna make a pancake out of it, right? They're gonna come along and say, "Oh, that's cute. You've got non-dilutive funding. That's got to go away. You know, if you want my money."
So what if you offer to sell them your non-dilutive portion along with the rest for whatever money they want to pay you for it?
I've never seen that. So you sell them your, well, then aren't you then diluting yourself if you sell them?
No, they're buying me out.
They're buying you out. Okay, we see those deals all the time. In other words, in fact, there's a special class of stock where founders can take money off the table when somebody comes in. That's much different. And that I will do. I've got another hack for you that sort of addresses your problem. So founders always have vesting restrictions, right? So think about it. You got three founders, and say somebody leaves after you get funded. Their shares go back into the pool. Everybody else is going to increase proportionately. Well, if you're the two original founders, you might say, wait a minute, why did the investors share in that increase? You know, they weren't part of the founding team. So I've got a way of doing that where when the third founder leaves and their shares are returned to the pool, only the other remaining founders will increase their percentage. So that's sort of what you're talking about. I think that, and that's one you'll get past the investor. That's one they'll live with.
I have another one, and this is pretty interesting. So suppose I'm authorizing 1 million shares. Who cares? I've authorized 1 million shares, and at inception, I've given 150,000 each to three founders, which now consists of 100% of the equity in the company. But they have 150,000 shares. There's only 1 million out there. So as they sell more and more off, they dilute. But part of the deal is that the company, if it exits at some time, can buy back a portion of their shares for $1 to bring them down to what we would previously have called a non-dilutive portion. It may not dilute all the way, but suppose you give me 150,000 shares, but you can buy back 100,000 of them for $1 the first year, or 50,000 for $1 the second year, or, you know, 25,000 the third year. Okay. So now, you know, as a tax guy, you hopefully understand what's going on here, right? So if I'm going to get my shares later, that's income later, which I then have to pay taxes on. So all this stuff where I vest later, I pay taxes on that as income if it's in exchange for work that I've done for the company.
Right, right.
Right. Whereas if I get all the shares up front, they have no value, so I have no taxes on them. When you buy them back for a dollar, I don't, you know, lose anything significant. So instead of the forward vesting, it's an inverse unvesting.
Right. No, we do that regularly. I mean, in tax language, we call a substantial risk of forfeiture. And we make an 83B election, and you close the compensation element. You don't have those bad tax consequences when that buyback right lapses. Yeah, no, we see that regularly.
Yeah, and that also gives you effective non-dilution, or at least limited dilution, down to some percentage, right? Because you have a portion of the total available shares.
Until you increase the available shares, which you'll do when the next investor comes in.
Oh, well, that's the point of having enough reserve in your shares. So you have 1 million, you've only used so many 100,000.
I got you. So you're setting a target. Well, that's a lot. By the way, that's simpler than what you described earlier, than simpler than the warrants, simpler than the non-dilutable shares. And what I tell a lot of founders is that, you know, let's be a little careful about some of this. Simple is better, because your company, you know.
Well, and it's a different name, and it's not apparent, but it's the same effect,
yeah.
Right? the net effect is I can't get diluted that far. If the company needs those shares to sell to somebody, that's fine. They can buy them back for the $1, sell them to other people, but I'm still only crunched down to the level that I agreed to in the first place.
Yeah, you may be onto something there.
All right. So this is where clever lawyers do their magic.
Yeah, but right. But part of the magic, though, is understanding what you can, again, it's persuasion, understanding what you can sell to the market. And what I tell people is let's be a little careful if we're going to get too creative here. Because your investor, you don't want them scratching their heads, wondering about this new novel thing that you came up with in your cap table. You want them focused on the team, right? The product, the market. Now, if you can get widespread adoption, like we've seen, by the way, Series F stock, Class F stock, you know, when you see widespread adoption and people are safes, for example, when safes first came along, people are like, what the heck is that thing? Why would I want that? Then it's a different story, but we have to be
able
to
explain Class F stock.
So I'm trying to take a lesson that I can share for this one is, you know, tech folks involve good lawyers, involve good financial people, right? This stuff bores me to tears. But not because it's, you know, legal and financial. It's the same sort of way that, you know, two engineers, you know, arguing the, you know, the finesse details of the current version of how to do the configuration of the, doesn't really matter. And I, you know, but, right, you know, if you don't cover these areas, they will cover you.
Chris, when I listen to this, this is fabulous. And he even said the word hacking.
Okay. Right, right. I caught that.
The whole legal world is hacking. That's what this is.
Well, he also said a phrase I can't pull up right now, but it's, you know, you can try too hard, right? You can try to make yourself safe with this, and before you know it, you're talking with your investors about legal and financial instruments instead of why you were going to make a lot of money.
Right? Right, and his summary at the end is, you know, I'm an influence operator.
Right.
So I'm trying to find, you know, the right set of magic, which he talked about before. So I put in the right set of magic so you get what you want as close as we can get to it without, you know, making the judge unhappy who has to look at it someday if there's a lawsuit, without making his lawyer perk up and say, wait, and without eliminating all those problems that cause it to fail. And to me, every time I talk to these guys, I learn something. So I was talking to Hank, who we interviewed before for the show, who's another one of my lawyers. And Hank is telling me about some of the provisions I have. And I've also been watching this stuff on TV talking about, you know, the judges and these, you know, big high profile cases. And what comes into focus is, even though I know it's not true, I've always looked at contracts as being a set of rules that at the end of the day, everybody signed it, you have to follow. And at the end of the day, that's just not what happens. What happens is it goes in front of a judge. And the judge says, or the arbiter, whoever it is, who's a judge or used to be a judge, or the other lawyers. And at the end of the day, it just doesn't matter what you said. They're going to say, it's not in the list of things I handle every day. It's a little bit unusual. And so I'm just going to rule it's no. Okay. And if you disagree with me, go appeal it. And you can work your way up to the Supreme Court and have them decide. And that, so you've now flipped a coin several times and spent a couple, you know, tens of millions of dollars in the process. Or you can figure out how to, you know, make it slide through with the way the rules work. And that's everything they're talking about is the same thing. You talk about unequal justice, right? Unequal justice isn't because of the rules. It's because of the way the people that are interpreting the rules look at them. And their opinion matters because that's how it works.
Right. And I don't, again, I guess I'm getting advice, you know, in several directions on this one, but like, you know, on the one hand, don't, as I said at the beginning of this, you know, don't overlook this area. You know, don't be a total fool. You know, make sure that you've got your interests covered. At the same time, you know, if you're starting a business up or doing any business, you know, you have not eliminated all your risk by definition. You're not going to eliminate it here. And if you're careful that you don't try too hard to protect the jewels to the point that you can't get to them. Right? But it's a balance like everything else. Like, how much encryption should you use? How much of, you know, money should we spend on marketing, right? How deep should we go down this hole? Deep enough, but don't get lost in it.
Well, I want to get back to hacking because that's the fun of it, right?
Right.
The fun of it is, this is just hacking. Yeah, you talk about
that's why we all love legal shows, right? Because at the end of the day, it matters how the what words the lawyer uses and how they're couched and how you say it. And that's the hacking of it, right? You know, it's not that, you know, the legal code says X, Y, Z. I mean, you shouldn't be able to turn it upside down. Then you don't have a legal system. But how do you hack it? You know, how do you say at this point, actually, Your Honor, that's a good point, and I'd like to refer you to this precedent. How about them apples? That's how it actually works.
Yeah, you better not say it that way, though.
Yeah, it depends on the judge.
Well, and that's why, so if you've been in court and listened to the testimony and stuff, it's all extremely pleasant and polite. Nobody is screaming. You know, there isn't theatrics. It's a different kind of theater, right? Yes, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. According to such and such, blah, blah, blah. All I have here, the such and such. And so it's just, I love it. It's no different than when we used to, you know, get into buildings, right? I guess I'm getting too old to, you know, go climbing up things to get into buildings, but that was almost never necessary anyway, because you could just hang out by the back door with cigarettes, right?
Right.
Just, you know, follow them in. Oh, we're just making friends everywhere we go.
I did this as recently as last Thursday.
Oh, yeah? You were hanging around somewhere smoking and went in the back door?
Basically, yeah. The tailgating in, you know, walking around. I was going someplace for a conference anyways, and rather than go through the process of getting badged, I just followed employees into the building that I thought had it and walked around there. And once you're past the gate guards, you can just ask anybody. Let's assume you're supposed to be there. You ask for directions, they'll help you out. And it's fun doing it, you know, in a safe environment. You know, I've been invited here. You know, and I told my host as soon as we actually did find him in a different building. We all laughed about it, but it's interesting.
So I, long time ago, I decided to stop doing that for fun. You know, I'll do it professionally if you're paying me and the right safeguards are in place, but I don't do it for fun anymore. I prefer to stand at the front door, not get in for a long time and complain a lot. But I think, sorry, that's how, but the thing that actually triggered it for me was when I was at Sandia National Labs, and I hope I'm not going to get in trouble for telling the story, but I think it's not an unreasonable story. So I had what's called an S clearance, which is basically secret. And to get into some places, you need a Q clearance, which is the DOE nuclear stuff Q clearance, which is, you know, named after QSP, which is the form you have to fill out to get the clearance, which is different from a top secret. So I didn't yet have a Q clearance. I subsequently got one. So I was going to Albuquerque to visit, and I had gotten a new badge, and the new badge had a Q on it. It was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, I'm sorry, my clearance was an L clearance, not an S clearance. I also had an S, that's different. So I had an L clearance. I ended up with a Q badge by accident. So, you know, I went over to Albuquerque with this Q badge and I showed it to the guard and said, okay, no, go ahead. Don't have to do anything else. Don't need an escort. And but I didn't go further. I said, okay, let me just explain it to you. Here's the badge that I should have. Here's the badge that they gave me.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, you know, you risk if you go a step further, I think you risk going to jail. So this is the problem with, you know, hacking, right? Is that you really do need to take care. And this is why, you know, several, you know, there's a CISO that's, you know, really famous for having been ultimately, you know, put in jail or, you know, been fined for testing security in his own company.
Well, you know, we recently lost Kevin Mitnick. You know, pancreatic cancer, 59 years old, you know, world famous for being one of the first people really busted for breaking things. And yeah, and to the topic of, you know, we're talking about legal process right now. On the one hand, yeah, advice everybody out there, be careful, listen to Fred, you know, think about things. And the counterpoint to that, of course, is the law is interpretive, right? You know, what I did last Thursday, like I was invited to a facility, you know, was I supposed to go in that particular building? Nobody told me I could. And no, I didn't have a badge. Am I going to be prosecuted? Absolutely not. You know, I have a high risk tolerance, but I'm not, you know, walking across a lot of lines either because jail isn't fun.
Right. You in theory could be prosecuted. In practice, you won't be.
Right.
And but learning that judgment, you know, that's something that's notoriously hard for people to do.
Right.
It's like, yeah,
Be self-aware. If you're a hacker, you're probably a little bit neurodivergent. You know, make sure you double check before you make those big decisions.
Or as I like to say, common sense isn't all that common.
Tuesday, October 3rd at 9 a.m., come to our free advisory session. Tuesday, October 10th at 9 a.m., go to Angel. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that.
There will always be people who are on the front lines of the ransomware battlefields and losing, and you just those are those people. That was Columbia, that was Equifax, that, you know, they know what the problems are. They somehow think they're not going to happen to them. Maersk with NotPetya, just unfathomable risk that they took every day. So we're seeing the fallout from that. We're going to see a whole lot more as these cyber wars gear up.
So in the long term, do you see us getting out of this? Or in the long term, do you think we're just going to continue to do this eternally? And we have really good job security in the cybersecurity space.
Have you read This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends by Nicole Pearl Roth?
I have not. Can you summarize it in like one sentence? How does the world end?
In a cybersecurity war, similar to NotPetya, but like with machines catching on fire, like happened on I-95 and outside Philly. Yeah.
I wanted to bring that up anyway, mm-hmm. but it'll be quite a while before it gets on the show, because it seems to me like every terrorist in the world now knows that's what you do. You go under, you know, the key bridges, you find the top 50 or 100 bridges in the U.S., and at the same time, you set something on fire underneath them, mm-hmm. and you've wiped out the transportation system for quite a while.
Yes.
A pretty serious threat and really no solid defense against it, right?
Right. Have you read Sandworm?
No, I haven't read anything.
That's even more frightening because it goes back to like the year 2006 and charts all of the research Russia has been doing to take down infrastructure with cyber. And, one story after the other. And it's just really terrifying.
Well, it's sort of. I mean, I haven't read it, but I'm aware of it anyway.
Because you read the news and you're in it, you see what happens in cybersecurity through your career. You know that it's happened, but to have it be put all together like that, you know, there's a similar.
It's not just Russia, mm-hmm. yeah, but it's not just Russia. China also, for a much longer time, has been doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
And frankly, we do the same thing to them, at least from a planning standpoint.
I do not think we are innocent on any count.
There you go. Okay. So it's a competitive world, and we're competing in.
You know, it's, you know how I am with my whole obsession with inevitability curves, right? You know, I look at, in my lifetime, the non-weaponification of space, right? I've always thought it was admirable but silly. Like, we'll all agree not to have weapons in space. It's like, okay, it's only the surface of the Earth will have human conflict, and we'll, you know, in the rest of the universe, you know, humans will never fight. And we're in this era where, yes, cyber war and so forth could be catastrophic. I think we worked through this because of the drivers behind inevitability curves. But in some scenarios, we don't work through it, right? You know, maybe there's a 90% chance that, you know, we'll figure it out, but that means that 10% we will not. And we'll actually suffer the consequences. And yeah, there are, you know, it's perhaps unusual for me to be the doomsayer, but yeah, there are structural problems and risks of systemic, global, catastrophic scale laying all over the place in the cyber realm.
I find myself not worried about that.
Right.
I find it not at all compelling that there's some structural end of the world event that's going to happen because of cyber. That the structural end of the world event that's going to happen is, you know, if it's going to happen, probably going to be, well, global climate change being ignored further because it's getting awful hot out there. Nuclear war, biological, whatever, which probably won't kill everybody, but it certainly deprecates a lot of stuff and so forth. But the thing that, you know, certainly can have a lot of harm to a lot of societies, and especially in the operational technology engineering in particular, but this goes back to what I think is the real problem, and that's the not going to happen to me. I mean, that's the first thing she said. Not going to happen to me. Is that really going to persist?
I don't think it can. You know, and as we talk about in a lot of other contexts, you know, I think we're somewhere along, maybe past the middle of the transparency maturity curve, but we don't really believe it, right? Really, what I need to do is make it look like I'm doing the ABC, where without actually, like, there's a cheat, there's a sneak, I can get around, you know, without doing it. And yeah, that this is one of the you know, it's not going to happen to me because I can't really see or assess or get a actionable feel for how likely or how big or whatever. So I'll just ignore it. And since it doesn't happen to most people, I'll be mostly proven correct that it didn't happen to me. You know, I think eventually, right? Again, this may be a long, long-term thing. Yeah, I think we're talking decades at least, but I think we continue to arc towards, from a security perspective, having better visibility, making better choices. Because again, we need that same better ability to make better choices for everything else, not just security.
So I think that that's not what's going to happen. I think that today it's already at the point where people are starting to truly recognize. I mean, it's almost at the unavoidable point, right? That is, lots and lots and lots of people who say or think they're not going to get hit are getting hit. And one after another is suffering the consequences. And ransomware is really fascinating to me because it's something that's increasingly recognized, and it's sort of the stupidest thing you can do. You know, there's like nothing to it. It's not a brilliant technical, you know, exploit. It's just, you know, I lied to some. I mean, some of this stuff is just flat lies. It's called pay me because I saw what you did last summer. And if you happen to do that last summer, then I guess you'll pay me. But, you know, even the stuff that encrypts or whatever it does, I think it's hitting enough people. They're getting enough realization around it that it's becoming real to them. They're starting to believe it. And when enough people get hit, I think that's when almost nobody can just be left out of it. The other thing is regulation is actually coming. And when they start actually enforcing these things, people will have to do something. And I think, you know, this is sort of infused with this other problem of the lack of expertise that's available in the world, right? Because I think there are currently only about 110,000, something like that, CISSPs, not that that's the only thing in the world, but that's all there are. Yeah. And so we can talk about getting all the expertise we want. If the expertise doesn't exist, we can't get it. So the standardization of these things, the creation of the mechanisms that say you must do this and you must do it that way, good or bad, is something that can force function things to happen. And as that happens, and it turns out that those aren't as good as they would like, they'll adapt them. And that's what happens when you start to centralize this in large volume.
Yeah, you know, the maturity curve that we've on, right? Ransomware is a great example because quite often when, you know, enthusiasts, yeah, something is becoming popular and becoming something that everybody does, enthusiasts get the timing all wrong. And I like to look at operational technology, critical infrastructure, cybersecurity is a good example of this. If you were in manufacturing, if you were in OT in the 1990s, and someone like Fred or I came along and said, hey, you need to spend all this money on cybersecurity, and you sent us away, you made exactly the right call. Because in the 1990s, you were not hacked. Nobody was, right? You know, the OT space was pretty well clear, right? And the ransomware is a good example, you know, because, you know, in my entire career, right, one of the first things you learn is like, well, yeah, but just because there's no real reason to attack you doesn't mean you won't be attacked. That's kind of less true in the first couple of decades. Most of the attacks were specific, right? Because of, you know, you're a company that's embracing high tech or whatever it is. Ransomware, to Fred's point, is not. You're on the internet. It's just automated. It's crime. It's not about you, right? Yeah. But for the first couple of decades, most of the risk really was associated with a very small number of organizations. And so I think I am agreeing with you, I think. I think we're getting to the point.
All right. Where, no,
for example, it's just random.
No, sorry, Chris. If we're agreeing, we have to stop because the world.
I know, right?
The world can end handle because of that. Yeah.
That's right. Only so much of that.
Well, just for clarity, the companies that engaged me, the entities that engaged me in that time frame were entities where that was happening to them, and that's why they engaged me. So I really wasn't telling everybody everywhere to change the world. I was just helping people that needed help.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on the Cyber Show, David puts software into containers and solves the logistics problems. Roger talks the walk of more preferences. Jennifer does operational risk management, but only for a few billion. A new pitch gets funded and takes off like a rocket. We hope. More fraud, spies, and lies, and who knows what else. Only on the Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.